Hey, thanks for downloading the latest podcast from PeterBCollins.com. I'd like to thank the people who subscribe to this program, including Robert Donjacour, Terry Pelio, Carolyn Simon, and Russell Archibald. Thanks for subscribing, and tell a friend, will you? Waiting for my time. Today, another podcast in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds. Got it made, it seemed the taste. And if you're a regular, you know that we've been exploring different views about the conflict in Syria. Bottom line, it's much more complicated than the corporate media presents here in this country. William Bowles is an independent journalist. And he's got a lot to say about Syria and other changes in the Middle East. Give it a listen. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Today, we're joined by William Bowles, a British writer and commentator who is a contributor to BoilingFrogsPost.com. Bill Bowles, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Give our listeners a little background. I know you did some reporting in the United States in the 1980s, and you've been holding forth from your native UK, at least based on your website, for about 15 or 20 years now.
No, not here. No, I've traveled around quite a bit. I left London in 1975 and moved to New York and stayed there until 1992 and then moved to Johannesburg and stayed there until 2002 and then moved back to London.
I see. Okay.
So I've been around a bit.
And what has been the focus of your writing, if you could sum it up for our listeners?
Yeah, well, I suppose ultimately it's politics. You know, it's current affairs, it's current events, it's what's going on around me. And it's been with me my entire life, you know. And it kind of comes naturally to me to do it. It's a skill that I'm lucky to possess, mm-hmm. and I think I've honed it just a little bit over the years. So I spend most of my time writing, really, and running the website and publishing other people's work, and of course reading, which you've got to do. You've got to read all this stuff.
That's true. And people can find out more at William Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S.
.info. Yeah.
And, Bill, you've been writing extensively, and Sabelle has been publishing your pieces about Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And here in the States, pardon me, we're captive to a corporate media that has very little interest in the conflict in Syria, and basically just stenographically delivers what the Pentagon and the Obama administration deliver to them. So we're very interested in your perspective from outside the United States. Mm-hmm. And so let me begin with a pretty open general question. What is going on in Syria? And is the Free Syrian Army actually limited to defectors from the army of Syria, reporting to Bashar al-Assad, or do we have a much more complex picture, somewhat like Libya a year ago?
Well, first off, let me say I don't think the real issue in in the terms that you're presenting it anyway, is what's going on inside Syria. I think what's more important is what's going on outside Syria. I mean, if you talk about, in broad terms, the Syrian state is under attack, and it's under attack from the outside, and it's doing it through forces that are inside Syria. And I think it's as simple as that. It's into, you know, it's colonial intervention under the guise of this responsibility to protect, a mantra that they've cunningly produced. And so really, I don't know what's going on inside Syria. Do you know what's going on? I think the state are fighting back against these characters, the Free Syrian Army, whoever they are. And clearly, there's just so much evidence available now that they are being not only equipped from the outside, but that there are actual, whether they're state troops or mercenary forces, are actually inside and have been there for some time. So I think it's a clear case, you know, of a good bit of the old gumboat diplomacy that we read about in history.
And the forces that we'll try to delve into here all benefit from the characterization of Bashar al-Assad as a brutal dictator. And much like Gaddafi in Libya, anyone who questions the response of other nations is seen as an apologist for a brutal and bloodthirsty individual and that regime. So let's begin with the obligatory caveats. In describing the situation, you don't have any investment in the continuation of the government of Bashar al-Assad. Is that correct?
Well, obviously not, and neither do I have any control over it, nor do I want any. I think, you know, as I wrote in one of my pieces, I think what the propagandists for the empire, I suppose let's call it the empire, it's easier than saying US, UK, NATO, etc. What they've done is that they've taken two completely disconnected ideas and joined them together. The human rights connection, which is, you know, Assad the dictator, the brutal dictator, and what was it Cameron called him, medieval.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to the Crusades again. They've put these two together, whereas in fact they're not. You know, the question of what kind of government Syria has, what concern is it of ours? We can like or dislike it. As I wrote in one of my pieces, you know, previous incarnations of the Ba'ath regime have killed communists, thrown them in jail, killed left-wingers. But they've also, you know, killed the Muslim Brotherhood as well. So, I mean, but to me, this is not, you know, this is really not relevant. That's for the Syrian people to decide whether they like the guy or not and want to get rid of him or not, without us coming along and doing what we normally do, which is interfere.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, using your term here, the empire, because I think it is less cumbersome than trying to identify the arrayed players, what's the bottom line here, in your view? If Assad is removed, then we have another country in that region in serious turmoil at a time when we have hot wars. You know, there's still a civil war in Iraq, even if the U.S. feels it's out of there. We've got Afghanistan. Pakistan is in turmoil. Yemen.
Libya. Don't forget, Libya's falling apart as well.
It is, yes. There's fracturing there. We have live fire in Yemen on a regular basis. We're flying drones over Somalia. We have this increasing tension driven by Israel against Iran.
So this
is a very volatile area. And when we hear people like President Obama calling for Assad to step down, one has to ask, well, what will come next? And what exactly is the motive to destabilize another country in an unstable region?
Well, I think you've said it. I think the motive is to simply destabilize these these regimes, whatever color, you know, whatever flavor they are, to take them out of the equation. I think, you know, once they fall, once it becomes a failed state, if you take Libya, for example, I mean, 90% of the country is, if not more, is uninhabited. It's desert. You know, the only thing that the country's got going for itself is its oil, and no doubt gas as well, but mainly it's its oil. So who cares what happens to the rest of the country? You know, as long as there's enough people to run the pumping stations and the drilling rigs and export the stuff, etc., etc., what do they care what happens to the people of Libya? Iraq used to be the most modern, the most developed country in the Middle East. You may not have liked Saddam Hussein, etc., etc., but what is it now? It's a non-state. It's been completely destroyed. All that infrastructure, which people paid with their lives for, literally, in order to get, has all been destroyed. Afghanistan, you know, what the Russians started, NATO has finished off. And it goes on and on and on. And I think this is one big mistake that a lot of people here who oppose the war make concerning this, about the objectives. They talk about the Americans losing in Afghanistan. They're not losing in Afghanistan. They're there. They're in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is not a country that can defend itself or stand up on its own two legs. And I think that this is the entire point. One by one, the empire is knocking these countries over, taking them out of the equation, because ultimately, Iran is the next step from Syria. And then where next? Well, Russia, China. And I think this is, you know, this is the plan. So, you know, what did they call it? Full spectrum dominance. Mm-hmm. And it's as simple as that.
So let me ask you then, for the angle from the point of view of the Royal House of Saud, because that is a Sunni royal family.
Mm-hmm.
That supports the minority government in Bahrain. And is now supporting the rebels in Syria against their Alawite minority dictatorship. And so Saudi Arabia's got a serious problem of inconsistency here, that it has helped the U.S. suppress any uprising in Bahrain while joining the United States in pushing to topple Bashar al-Assad. So talk about it from your point of view and the angle of the interests of Saudi Arabia in the region.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, just like Israel, but in almost the same kind of sense, Saudi Arabia is, you know, part one of the empire's, what do they used to call them, satrapies? You know, a local consigliere for the empire, and their interests, of course, are not to have any kind of competition. As to what's actually going on inside and whether they're exploiting all these various religious and tribal differences, I have no idea. I just see them as another part of the jigsaw in the kind of strategic games that principally, but not exclusively, but principally the United States is playing in the region. And I think it's keep the place destabilized. That is the whole purpose. Because while it's destabilized, they can get on with business. And that's what they're doing. They're making billions out of all of these wars. The United States has a war economy, pretty much. The rest of it is just like here, is consumption. And, you know, so the more wars you've got going, the better. Whether you lose them or win them, so-called win them or lose them, I don't think it makes any difference anymore. I think this is a new kind of capitalist destruction of capital, which is, you know, keep lots of wars going all at the same time. And I don't think that people realize that this is actually going on, because they've been fed this lie that we're out there killing people to save them from themselves. And unfortunately, they appear to believe it. Well, at least not to want to do anything about stopping it from happening. And I think that this is the key issue. It's not what's happening in Syria or in Pakistan or in Libya. What is happening here in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in the, you know, in those NATO countries who are taking part in this kind of spectacle of slaughter.
Bill, Bill, I want to talk about this a bit because in 2001, 2002, we had the rift between these European nations, Rumsfeld, Cheney, they called them the old Europe because they really didn't want to participate with Iraq. They said they didn't. So this was when the previous administration was going after the Eastern European blocs and all the new NATO members. But now we have been seeing this shift. I mean, what happened? Suddenly the old Europe has aligned itself with these imperialistic wars with the United States, with President Obama. So now we see France and Germany and UK even hungrier and thirstier than U.S. in this grabbing competition. So what causes do you see as the major contributing factors to this sudden shift, or may I say gradual shift, since we are looking between 2002 and 2008, because we saw it with Libya, we are seeing it with Syria, we are seeing it with the propaganda building up with Iran. So why suddenly old Europe is back on U.S., you know, at U.S.'s side and as partners in this imperialistic pursuit?
Well, I think it's the same as it was in 2003. I just got back from South Africa in 2002, and I had no real connections to what passed for any kind of progressive or left, you know, movements such as they are here or anything. But when prior to the invasion of Iraq, there were over. I was on that march, and there were well over a million, a lot of people say closer to 2 million people on that march. That's the biggest demonstration in the history of the country, let alone, you know, excuse me, the 20th century or 21st century. But it didn't mean a thing. Nothing. You know, it was as if it never happened. And once that kind of tipping point had passed, the media, you know, bent over and took it. They just lay down and literally overnight. I mean, literally overnight. Any questioning of the war literally disappeared from any kind of coverage in the media, in the mass media, the BBC especially. You know, people got fired. The director of news resigned, etc., etc., etc. The clear force of the state, and along with its complicit media, came into force and pushed everybody along with it. And of course, once there were those, you know, ubiquitous boots on the ground, the whole patriotic, jingoistic machine moved into full force here. Our boys over there, and there's a whole town here which is dedicated to, I suppose, you know, the dead soldiers who were brought back from Afghanistan and Iraq and wherever else they're fighting. And I don't think that anything has changed. I think what has changed, I think, is that, especially in the United States, there were such great expectations for Obama, you know, which I never, ever believed, not for a second, and I wrote as such.
Neither did I.
Thank God. Well, us and Barr, Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. But, you know, this is, I think you asked me what's underlying this apparent shift. I think it's economics, isn't it? It's always economics. Is that there's a global crisis of capitalism, which in previous eras has been resolved by essentially world wars. And I think even with the destruction of the Soviet Union and now the so-called socialist bloc and whatnot, which acted as a kind of counterbalance to the ravages of capital across the planet, it doesn't exist anymore. On the other hand, you've still got Russia and China armed to the teeth. So the Americans can still not, or the empire can still, it still can't just go traipsing all over the world doing whatever it wants. And I think, you know, this last 20 years since the fall of the Soviet Union has been a kind of interregnum period when forces started to sort themselves out. and powers which had been major before either, you know, slid into obscurity or reasserted themselves, and new powers rose up. You know, you've got China, you've got Brazil, you've got India. And I think it's a return to the kind of classical 19th century sense of, you know, competing capitalist powers all fighting it out, battling it out over our bodies.
So
does that make sense?
Bill, tell us what you're getting from the non-Murdoch British press and from the BBC in terms of coverage in Syria. And in particular, do people raise questions about who the Free Syrian Army is supported by or a proxy to?
Well, not the mainstream press. I mean, you will read accounts, you know, reports occasionally, but they're not major news. Whereas the BBC, for example, today, I mean, I've written about it. I wrote a piece called, you know, Activists Say, because every time I read a BBC report, supposedly, you know, meant to be news, it said, activists say, you know, such and such happened. Another one today, as I was sitting here waiting on your phone call, I'm reading through the feeds that are coming in, and there's another BBC report. Activists say this and that happened. And you go, well, you look at it, where's the verification for it? You know, there is no verification. When you look at BBC headlines and you compare them to headlines even from other mainstream media, it's like it's been stamped out of an assembly line. It bangs on about the same old problem, the same issues. It bangs on about, for example, the battle that's gone down between the Free Syrian Army and, apparently, according to somebody who knows more about it than me, Assad's Republican Guard and his 4th Armored Unit, which took place in a situation which is actually only three blocks square where these guys were hung out, the FSA were hung out. Now, when the BBC talked about what had happened for a month, it talked about this neighborhood being under bombardment by the Assad army for a month. But in fact, it was a battle going on between two sides. You know, yes, of course, Assad's forces were firing at the FSA, but the FSA were also firing at them. So, you know, it's a completely one-sided kind of view of what's going on. Aside from that whole, you know, the whole underlying rationale, this, you know, responsibility to protect thing. They, you know, all of this other stuff, the stuff that the BBC does, for example, what it does is actually reinforce that lie of the responsibility to protect. That, you know, here they are, there's literally a civil war going on, or if you'd like, an attempted, a long, long, drawn-out attempted coup of the Assad regime, but it's being presented as if it's, you know, ordinary people in cities of like Homs or wherever who have just taken up arms and they've been holding off the 4th Armored Division mm-hmm. and the Republican Guard for a month. So we don't see the real situation, because it would blow the lie apart if we realised that we'd actually fomented it. I think, you know, the intervention started long, long, long before the weapons started dropping into the country from Turkey or wherever they were coming from. I think it started with the introduction of various kinds of so-called NGOs, the funding of newspapers and radio, you know, the usual stuff, the stuff that USAID and so on and so forth, the Republican Institute, I mean, you know the names. They go into countries like Venezuela, for example, and they fund oppositions. They work with oppositions. Mm-hmm. And I think what they did with Syria was that the general kind of chaos that was going down with countries in insurrection all over the place, they decided that the time was ripe to notch it, you know, take it up a notch.
Now, Bill, you referenced earlier that a red flag for you is when you see these reports attributed to activists who are mm-hmm. unnamed. Now, you can understand that people in Syria are very fearful and don't want to put their names on stories. But I do get your point. And for us over here, the thing that we notice is that there are daily reports of significant casualties, of people dying in this crossfire. And yet the reported death toll has been at 5,000. We've been hearing the number 7,000 more recently.
Yeah, 7,000 today, actually. Yeah.
But it really seems that the global coverage doesn't match the details that we get reported on a regular basis. And it raises skepticism, and certainly, you know, we do understand that with some exceptions, there aren't that many reporters who are in Syria and who survive filing reports.
I beg to differ here. I think, for example, Russia today, ironically, if I turn on my TV and I want to find out, get a better idea of, let's say, what's happening in Syria, I tune to Russia Today. What an irony that I can get a more accurate news report from the middle of Homs or Damascus or wherever it happens to be. So I don't think that's entirely true, but I think there's another issue kind of wrapped up in this whole thing. And that is the way the media have actually constructed the way events unfold. And I think it's more than just, you know, being a mirror, or if you like, a distorting mirror to events. I think that they are intimately interconnected with the events themselves. In other words, if they create the impression that you've got a vicious dictator just going around butchering his people, just apparently for the fun of it, then of course what it does is it creates the right kind of ambiance for people to accept us doing the same to them. And you saw this with Libya, and you've seen even a replay on all these, you know, dead babies in incubators. And I read another one the other day which had one single source, which ultimately devolved from an Israeli source, and yet it spread like wildfire. I started seeing the same story cropping up all over the place in the space of a day. And it was one where it was alleged that a guy inside Syria was privy to a report that Assad had said that if Syria gets invaded by foreign forces, then they will drop missiles on Tel Aviv. Okay. The story went round, and then it vanished without trace. It just disappeared. It's like the other story, which paralleled the one in Kuwait, which triggered the whole Kuwaiti thing of the dead babies in incubators. There was a talk that because of Assad's shelling of a hospital, the power had got cut and 18 babies died in the incubators. Well, it turned out to be rubbish. I mean, you know, so all of these stories come up, the disinformation, even I think... I'd go as far as to say that all this stuff about they're going to invade Israel and there's the United States tugging Israel back, you know, like it's got a Doberman on the leash or something, you know, I think it's all theatre. And what it does do is it creates an environment, an atmosphere, which is conducive to actually doing it someday. So when it does actually happen, nobody will be surprised, you know. Again, I keep, and it's what I try to do with my writing, is coming back to where I am in the UK. All this stuff goes on, not because of Assad or because of Saddam Hussein or Al-Qaeda or whoever it is, but because of us. And to me, the solutions are here. We've got to stop our governments doing this kind of stuff. We've got to get rid of governments that, you know, think it's great to go around dropping bunker buster bombs on people and depleted uranium and et cetera, et cetera, and stealing people's land and property and resources and just kind of killing them willy-nilly wherever we go. And it's, oh, sorry, we didn't really mean to do that. You know, how many thousands of times have they got to say it? So, you know, I think that, yeah, I think the media now... play, I think, a central, I don't know how big a role, but I think it's a central role in shaping not merely what we know about the world or don't know about the world, but what we do about it or don't do about it.
Right, and I think that's not limited even to only mainstream media, because I have been facing this for the past 3-4 months with the so-called alternative or mm-hmm. the popular alternative media. For example, in November, we were the first website that reported on activities in Turkey, Syria border through mm-hmm. U.S. Air Force base there, in Incirlik Air Force base there.
That's right.
Training these rebels, and our sources, both from those from the within the U.S. military, and also my sources in Turkey. Again, these are military sources.
Mm-hmm.
They tried very hard to take this story in October 2011 to the mainstream media, documented, witnessed,
mm-hmm.
and nobody mm-hmm. wanted to run it. Then they went to the second tier, and this is the so-called alternative channels, which I call quasi-alternative. That's why they're popular.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't touch it. And even though we published this, so we were the first to put it out there, when we tried to disseminate, actually we were attacked. I mean, there is a website that started as anti-war. It's antiwar.com. But in the last few years, they are only advertising as anti-war. Website.
Well, there's two anti-wars, isn't there? No, there's another one called, I think, therealantiwar.com.
Okay, well, I have to go and find a real one because I do miss it, and this antiwar.com is definitely not what it used to be. But they actually attacked me. They said, why are you putting this information that supports Assad and Assad's regime? Why are you supporting a dictator? So the propaganda is really working even as self-censorship, because the way they dress it up and give it, if you question the validity and the factuality of what's being reported, all this false information, then you're accused of supporting a dictator. It's like,
well, I think Sybil, that's politics entering into the equation, isn't it? It's why Tariq Ali, you know, came out and famously to Russia Today as well. And I wrote a piece about it. It enraged me, you know, where he stood up and said, Assad has to go. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a guy, he's a member of the Socialist Workers' Party here in the UK. And I've written a piece about them as well. Which I don't normally do, but it so enraged me because that's, you know, as I wrote, you see, Assad regime is not really anti-imperialist; it's just pretending to be. What the Syrian people need is a real socialist and a real anti-imperialist government. Fine, yeah, that would be fantastic. You know, I'd love to see a real socialist government. I'd love to see a real socialist government here in the UK. But that's not the way it is, you know. As I've written before quite a few times, back in the days when colonial countries were fighting for their independence, for example, in 1956 when Nasser took over the Suez Canal and the French, Israelis and British cooked up an invasion. Who did we support? You know, did we not support Nasser against kind of neo-colonial grab of Egypt's resources? But the guy wasn't a progressive. He locked communists up. You know, he tortured people, shot people, he did all kinds of nasty things. Does that mean we should have said no? Look, you know, when the right guy makes independence, then we'll support you. You know, that's why I say that when politics in that kind of ideological sectarian sense gets involved, then they find themselves on the same side as the people who are trying to rationalize through responsibility to protect, etc., etc. You know, and it's look, Sybil, it's life, isn't it? It's that people are going to come along. We went through the same thing with Libya, because in the very beginning of the whole downfall of Gaddafi, I think myself and maybe some people on Global Research and whatnot were the only people saying, you know, we've got to defend the guy, the country, against this takeover. And a lot on the left were coming along and saying, no, the man's a dictator, he tortures people, he does this, he does that, etc., etc., etc. As if this is something different for a whole host of countries right round the planet, you know. So, and it's not for me to do anything about Gaddafi, it's for the Libyan people, should they so choose. And I think that this all comes back to this whole Western mentality that we know best, that unless there's a white guy there doing something, running something, telling somebody else what to do, and doing it the way we do it, etc., over here with our so-called democracies, which now everybody knows are a complete farce and an illusion, etc., you know, I think that this is where it all comes from. It's the kind of the ideology of racism which permeates literally our everyday lives. We don't even know we're doing it. You know, when they started bombing Libya and destroying its infrastructure, etc., with a bunch of bandits down on the ground as their so-called rationale for doing it, you know, people here, nothing happened. You know, there was a few hundred people went on demonstrations and maybe even a few thousand at one point. But, you know, it was a small war and the Brits have been running small wars for about 600 years and large ones as well. So I think that there's a general air of fatalism because our democracy doesn't work. It doesn't matter what we think or what we say. It doesn't make any difference because these guys will go on doing it anyway. So all of this stuff is all taking place, I think, inside an environment of complete disenfranchisement from the political process. We have no voice. We have no structures that have any kind of real impact and role and voice in society. And so, I mean, you know, a lot of the time, I don't know if you feel this way, Isabel. You know, you feel like you're pissing in the wind and that you're going nowhere. And what is the point of banging your head against the wall when you're up against this monstrous empire, which clearly, the way it's behaving, will destroy, well, everything, hopefully, except itself. Sorry, that's a depressing...
No, I go through that every week. In fact, sometimes I go through that several times a day. And
yeah,
say,
exactly,
you know, I'm
exactly.
Just, this is not getting anywhere. But then the alternative becomes, this, you know, you just sit there and you take it. And you then you get that tiny bit of energy back to say, well, I put it out there. So maybe it will start with a few people and maybe it will expand. But I believe you're absolutely right. And we have turned, I mean, all of us, not just U.S., U.K., everywhere, into the nations of zombies. Because people, as they're bombarded, I mean, after a while, the sensitivity to war has just been lost.
Well, I think also, Sibel, I mean, if you look at when the first insurrection took place, and it wasn't an Arab Spring, it was actually an African Spring, because it took place in Tunisia, which is in Africa, but, you know, anyway, when the first insurrection, let's call it this, insurrection took place in Tunisia, and it was followed by one in Egypt and so on, the first thing that was apparent to me was that this was largely without form, without any clear direction of where it wanted to go, except that, you know, these kind of dictators who've been hanging into power there for decades and decades, mostly kind of using a military dictatorship of one kind or another, etc. They wanted them to go, but there was no clear idea about, you know, what to replace the whole thing with. And I looked and I thought, okay, you know, fine, this is great, it's a good start. But it's not a revolution. It's not even the beginning of a revolution. It's just the first stirrings after decades of slumber and repression and betrayal, one might add, of for example, the Egyptian people by their leaders, etc., etc. And so it's just the start of a process. And also, you know, that I don't go along with it completely, but there is no doubt, there is no doubt that the Western agencies of one kind or another have been playing a role in one way or another, for example, in attempting to control the direction that these insurrections took. And I can speak from direct personal experience in South Africa when I was working for the ANC prior, in the 2 years prior to the 94 elections. In fact, I set up there an election information unit for the ANC and had a small staff of comrades that worked with me collecting information and disseminating it. So anyway, the thing was this, it was that, you know, you had the Republican Institute knocking on the door, you had the Democratic Institute knocking on the door, all wanting to get in before the elections took place as so-called observers, you know, or advisors, or consultants, etc., etc. These included, at one point, Greenberg Lake, who were advising the ANC on how to run their election campaign. And Greenberg Lake, if you remember, was Clinton's election manager, etc. And they also advised Tony Blair, and Tony Blair and the Labour Party were also advising the ANC. You know, so you get in the door and it's all innocuous. Just trying to help out, you know, blah, 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 help you, you know, cut the corners and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, what they're doing is they're subtly shaping the direction and the way and the emphasis and this, that, and the other. And they're masters at it. They've been doing it for decades.
Yes. You know, with Iran, you know, my father, my uncles, they mm-hmm. were all out there getting Mossadegh. So even when people, they got very close to achieve what they were, you know, achieve their objectives, mm-hmm. it was bam, it was gone. So the hopelessness that sets in these countries, saying, we don't matter. Because even if we have a successful, well-organized uprising, and even if we accomplish it, all it takes, they just come in there with their planes, that they take our people in jail, and they just come and put another one of their dictators in there.
Well,
where
I think,
to go, what
yeah.
to do?
Well, I was living in New York when the Shah was overthrown, and in the run up to 79, and I knew
there.
A bunch of kind of exiled Persians in New York. And I used to hang out with them on a cafe on Broadway around in the 70s somewhere, because that's where they all hung out. And we used to talk about what was going down. Now, most of these guys were in, I suppose, what was the Iranian section of the Fourth International. These were all Socialist Workers' Party members, Iranian Socialist Workers' Party members. And after the Shah fell, I remember... Not exactly, but the way it unfolded to my eyes and ears in living in New York was that a battle went down between the left and the established religious order, the mullahs and landowners, etc., etc. And that the left lost.
Right.
They got wiped out, in fact.
Right.
I mean, physically exterminated.
Right.
A battle went down between left, progressive, trade unions, etc., etc.,
right.
And the landed order, which happened to be the mullahs, because they owned land, and they didn't want to see that land being taken away, or perception that that land would get taken away and their power. And I think if you look at Egypt, you've got this bizarre economy which is owned by the army. They own, telecommunications corporations, hotels, transportation, factories, production, real estate, you name it, is owned by the army. So you've got a military capitalist dictatorship, literally. These are bizarre kinds of creations that are directly the result of the empire's control and the back. This is what's left after the Cold War is over. And in fact, if you look at it that way, if you look at 1991, you know, the invasion of Iraq and the fall of the Soviet Union, the fact that it took place at the same time is not coincidental. had the Soviet Union survived and hopefully prospered under Gorbachev's glasnost and all that stuff, I don't think you would have seen, you know, Operation Enduring Freedom or whatever it was called taking place at all. But what you saw was, you know, this great global shift in power, and for 75 years, a whole bunch of countries that have been denied access to capital, denied access to the West, suddenly were there for the taking, except they weren't. They weren't. You know, Iraq wasn't there for the taking. Syria wasn't there for the taking. These countries and a lot of other countries had kind of quasi, you know, some kind of socialist setup. They had collective goods. You know, they had state ownership of transportation and power and a whole bunch of other things. The collective still existed. The commons. The common good still existed in these countries. And also, they controlled their own economies. You know, they banned trade that competed with their own production, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, these are all inhibitions to the spread of capital, to the empire taking over everything. And they've got to be removed. And when you read the small print, when these guys talk about why they, you know, destroyed Iraq, in small print, it always says, you know, the spread of the free market, and Hussein, like Assad, whatever you can say about these guys, you know, they resisted this, but were resisting it less and less, I think. And I think, you know, part of the reason that the Assad regime found itself in so much trouble with its population was it was doing precisely what the West wanted, which was to privatize, take away subsidies, etc., etc. In other words, reduce the standard of living of the Syrian people, and they didn't like it.
Well, Syria also accepted outsourced contracts to torture suspects in the so-called global war on terror.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, and you saw the same kind of dance go down with Gaddafi and his crazy green socialism or whatever it was called.
Well, and also that he at least appeared to accept responsibility for the Lockerbie incident when there's great evidence to the contrary.
I think that in fact the people in Scotland, even the survivors and kind of relatives of the 400 or 500 people who died in that crash, etc., a few of them will say, we know it was a setup, that this guy Megrahi was a patsy, he was set up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that Gaddafi ever admitted that they were responsible. I think what he did say, just to, he could get back in the empire's good graces, he went through the motions of saying that they were responsible. And all this thing about we're going to abandon our WMD program. You know, it's like the North Korean nuclear weapon. I'm not at all convinced that, you know, they've got one. They might like everybody to think they've got one.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not at all convinced that a country as poor as North Korea has the capacity to produce a workable nuclear weapon and then deliver it. I mean, yeah, they might be able to make one and then sit on it.
Right.
But yeah,
I share your skepticism.
I think there's a lot of hype going down, Bill, around all these things.
Bill, a moment ago you were edging up to some commentary that was published at Boiling Frog's Post on the 2nd of March, an
mm-hmm.
article called The Phenomenon of the Red Tops. And you write about the concept of the right to protect. And this surfaced with the so-called humanitarian hawks in the Obama administration,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
who
mm-hmm.
advocated the NATO incursion over and in Libya to prevent a massacre they thought was about to occur in Benghazi. And, of course, far more people have been massacred in Syria, and yet we don't see the same standard applied. So,
but surely, you know, I think the difference is that with the alleged Benghazi massacre, which of course didn't take place,
mm-hmm.
And as to the massacres in Syria, I have no evidence one way or the other as to what's been going on. I don't think that the Assad regime is a particularly nice regime at all. Especially if it's fighting for its life.
Well, let me sharpen my point. What I was trying to say is that the reports at the time that you know, people were persuaded to take action against Libya were, you know, not as serious as the reports that we're getting from Syria at this time. And so my point is not that we can rely on either to be fully accurate, but these are the arguments that are being used for some sort of foreign intervention and to arm the Free Syrian Army and to demonize Russia and China for their Security Council vetoes.
Well, I think firstly, the difference is that it's that awful, awful UN resolution, the no-fly zone. And that's why, because I think the Russians and the Chinese, they know. So I think, you know, I'm not, you know, I try and look at these situations with my eyes wide open. The Russians do the things they do out of their own national self-interest, as they should. You know, sometimes those things coincide with, you know, my beliefs, for example, or what I think should be done or shouldn't be done, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes they don't. Obviously, you know, the they took a short-term view, and firstly, and secondly, they were just making a, if you like, a reappearance on the world stage, exerting themselves as a world power, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they just cold-bloodedly said to themselves, well, look, you know, it's too far away to be a real problem to us, so we'll just abstain, you know. But of course, you know, the empire had what it wanted, the no-fly zone, and the empire was the first to admit that it was a declaration of war. And under the UN Charter, no-fly zones are declarations of war. De facto declarations of war, and the Americans, I read it in the New York Times, you know, where one official in the Obama administration said, you know, look, if you set up a no-fly zone, you've got to enforce it, and to enforce it, you've got to shoot things, you've got to blow up things, you've got to shoot planes down, you know. And so it goes. So they had that. The door was open. And the door was open for the empire to go wherever it pleased. And I think that they thought that they could do the same thing with Syria. Even though Syria, you know, is a country with 70 million people, and Libya is a country with 3 million or 4 million people, and a lot of those didn't even come from Libya, but were kind of, you know, migrant labor and so on. So I think they thought they could pull it off again, and that was why they got so upset with Russia and China. Because they thought, oh, look, hey, look how easy it was to get rid of Gaddafi. It took about 3 months. You know, it cost us about $50 billion, which is nothing. You know, that's chump change for the empire to take out something that's in your way. But I don't think, you know, Syria is not like that. It's heavily armed. It's got a large standing army. It's right in the middle of the cauldron of the Middle East. And I think I think over attempt by the empire to actually invade or in some way attack Syria, all it's going to do is make Assad's regime even stronger because, you know, you can see from the general populace of that it may be divided, but when it comes to defending Syria, I think you're going to find that the vast bulk of the population are going to back the regime. And, you know, what they do afterwards is another matter. So I think, you know, we need to bear in mind that the empire increasingly has acted with impunity at what it does. But I think that things are starting to unravel. I think this whole thing, they pulled it off with Libya, the humanitarian intervention. You remember the black mercenary rumor that was put around, etc., or Gaddafi's Air Force bombing civilians, etc., etc., which were the two major so-called incidents that, mm-hmm. that triggered that resolution.
Well, also the charges of rape and command-issued Viagra.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot that one. Yeah, that's right. You know,
abusing.
So I don't think, you see, I think it hasn't worked this time. Even with the help of the mass media, especially here at BBC and Channel 4, for example, I have blitzed the airwaves with anti-Assad propaganda. And that, I mean, that's all you can call it. You don't see anything. And yet, this is the same, you know, this is the same Assad Syria that the BBC TV last year ran a kind of 12-part a documentary series inside Syrian schools with Syrian school children, and that ran for 12 weeks, and it was kind of interesting because there it was, you know, inside the country with children and their parents and the teachers, etc., etc., etc. This is the same country that is now a medieval, you know, run by a medieval monster, a barbaric monster who just goes around killing. I don't think it's working. And I think that when you see all these pronouncements that have been made, especially recently, on the one hand, you've got McCain, you know, doing a Dr. Strangelove, and saying, go on, drop bombs on them, man. You must have read that today with McCain. Mm-hmm. But you've got other guys saying, well, hang on a minute, I'm not sure. It's like when you hear the military talk about invading Iran, they're going, yeah, it might be a good idea, but I don't know, taking on Iran? Because they know that Israel doesn't have the capacity to take on Iran. It doesn't have the military capacity, it doesn't have the industrial capacity to support wars longer than a couple of weeks. And then it has to withdraw, and you saw that go down in when it invaded Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
They just literally don't have an economy large enough to support a sustained conflict. And you know, but this is not, these kinds of things are never brought up.
Well, Bill, I'm glad you raised that, because I wanted to close with your comments about the events. We're speaking here in the first week of March, mm-hmm. when President Obama had to face an amazing onslaught of political pressure as Benjamin Netanyahu came to town. AIPAC was meeting with 14,000 members, and they control virtually all of the elected officials on Capitol Hill. And while I've been very critical of Obama on many issues, mm-hmm. including his commentary in support of Israel,
mm-hmm.
he did a very interesting dance where he said, we've got Israel's back, and, you know, we're in lockstep, and, you know, we'll never desert our most important ally in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
he also said, not now, and told Netanyahu that it wouldn't be wise to launch a military strike. Now, Netanyahu appeared to accept that advice, but still sputtering that Israel is a sovereign nation that will make its own foreign policy.
Well, he's got to say that, hasn't he?
The problem for me is that he wants the right for a unilateral preemptive strike with the insurance, not just the assurance, but the insurance that the United States will clean up the mess that Israel creates.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how all that looks from the UK right now.
Well, you know, look, the way I see it, if you look at the relationship between the United States and Israel, I mean, historically going back to the foundations of the country in 1948, you know, there are two arguments going down here in the UK, and I know in the US, maybe even more so in the US. You know, it's the old, is the tail wagging the dog, or is the dog wagging the tail? You know, is Israel pulling the U.S. along by its nose, et cetera, et cetera? Is Israel simply a kind of, you know, a lackey, basically, if you like? Well, I think a good description of them is a mini-empire, you know? It's a mini-empire an outcrop, a base, if you like, a fortress, slap-bagging in the middle of the Middle East, a crucial strategic, historically. You've only got to look at the history of the place and the British involvement. Of course, the British had to be the cause of all this, as they're the cause pretty much of everything else that's gone wrong in this on this planet for the last 400 years. I don't think that Israel does a single thing when it comes to, you know, confrontations, invasions, blowing up things, killing people, etc., etc. I don't think it does a thing without first clearing it with the White House. That's my opinion. I don't think that the United States pours I don't know how many billions of dollars of military and other kinds of financial aid into that country because Israel says so. I don't think they do it because the AIPAC and the so-called Israeli lobby do it. I think imperialism and the political class of America do it because it's in their interest. And I think that, you know, the day when Israel, just like all of the other allies, so-called allies that the United States has picked up along the way and then dropped, I think, you know, if push come to shove, and you really do have some kind of crazy maniac, let's say a religious maniac, end-of-days maniac, kind of lodged as Prime Minister of Israel, and, you know, he starts shooting his mouth off about, you know, taking out Iran or whatever it is, I don't think the Americans are going to be dragged into that. Why should they? What is the advantage of being dragged into a war that nobody can possibly win? And I think, you know, that... and sure, of course, AIPAC, as a representative of the Israeli state, of course it has its, you know, but no more so than Monsanto. You know, does AIPAC have more influence over the United States government than Monsanto?
I would say yes.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Okay, how about this? They have far more influence on U.S. media, publication houses, and Hollywood, and Monsanto doesn't have even one-third of it.
The fact that a lot of the guys who run these institutions are Jewish doesn't make capitalism Jewish. There are all kinds of historical and sociological reasons why that should be so. I mean, why are all the best songwriters to come out of the U.S. in the 20th century Jewish? You know, why are all the best Broadway writers, why are they all Jewish? You know, why are some of the best writers, you know, novelists, why are they Jewish? I don't know. It's, you know.
Well, Bill, let me just address that point for a moment, because I went to an event last weekend sponsored by the Irish American Crossroads Festival.
Yeah.
And a brilliant Irishman, Mick Maloney, made a presentation about what you're talking about. It's about vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah,
and the Irish actually dominated it first, and then Jewish guys came in, often using names that suggested they were Irish, and kind of took it over. And at the same time, one of the leading composers, George Cohan, who appeared to be Jewish, was actually Irish.
I'd say this. I don't think it's a coincidence that you've got a lot of Jews in the media, in high positions, etc. But I think, you know, there's an awful lot of Jewish Americans who are unemployed right now. I would say that there were more Jews unemployed than Jews that are millionaires. So, you know, the fact that they're concentrated in those... In a sense, all it does is expose the actual relationship between the economics and the politics. You know, it benefits U.S. capital to have Israel where it is, doing what it is, especially an economy that is dominated by the military and by the media. You know, they both have a vested interest in, you know, it's like... looking at this, I had it as a screen on my desktop of my Mac. It was a screenshot of CNN when the Iran thing looked like it, as far as the media were concerned, you know, they were going to have a real show. You know, the headline running across the top of the screen underneath, above the 2 ounces was, you know, Iran war alert. You know, these guys, it's grist for the mill as far as they're concerned. The fact that it also coincides with the agenda of the political class and the business class, etc. Well, you know, because the media is owned by big capital. I mean, if it was Boiling Frogs getting up and saying, you know, bomb Iran, nobody's going to take any notice of you. If it's me standing up saying, you know, bomb Iran, nobody's going to take any notice of me. But when you've got major media who, if you take General Electric, for example, which owns NBC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Bill Gates and MSNBC, and you find that all of these corporations are all interconnected, and that a media corporation is just as likely to be making bazookas, you know, as it is CDs or DVD players or something like that, you realize that they're all, you know, they all have a vested interest in keeping this whole show going. Because they're not the ones doing the dying. You know, they're not the ones who are getting sent to Afghanistan or to Iraq or wherever it is. You know, they're sitting back making money and making television programs out of it. So I think all of these things are really, to me, anyway, where I'm standing, and essentially the same thing goes here. It's a little politer. We do it more politely in England than you guys do. But I think it's just as hypocritical. And perhaps, in a way, even more insidious, because here, you know, you get the feeling that it's all fair play, chaps, you know. And come on, have a jolly good time. Go over to Afghanistan and we'll whop a few ragheads, shall we? Oh, have some fun. You know, it's all that kind of attitude of gung-ho, kind of, hey, you know, the fighting tradition of the British, etc. You know, we've been to Afghanistan at least twice before and lost both times. The track record's not good. So maybe, you know, look, I don't know. I've run out of things to say on that subject.
Well, on that note, I will politely thank you for joining us, and we always defer to the British for better manners.
Oh, no, you shouldn't. It's all a smokescreen. It's an illusion.
All right, Governor. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Bill. On us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.